This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The state legislature is working on bills that would make female genital mutilation a state crime, increase the penalties for animal cruelty, and include controls on prescribing opiates. State Senator Margaret O'Brien has sponsored some of the bills related to those issues. The Republican represents Kalamazoo County in the state Senate. Margaret O'Brien, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We are speaking on Friday, so let's start with the female genital mutilation bills, which actually passed the House yesterday. Actually, there's a couple different sets of bills that have to go back and forth between the House and Senate. We heard about this particular case of three girls in Michigan who had this procedure had been done on. Is that what brought attention to this, or was this something that was on your radar before we heard that story?
Well, thank you for asking that, because, you know, many people have thought that at least the Senate package of bills was just because of the story. But actually, it was, I don't remember if it was in January or February, I had read some national article about female genital mutilation, and I didn't realize that this was something happening in the United States. So I started doing some research and had interest in this prior to the case that happened in Livonia. And I actually put in a bill request prior to the Livonia case asking for language on banning it. So for me, it started prior to this. The House package started once the Livonia case happened. I know there had been some legislators who had had interest in that, but I think that's what really had spurred them on. The House bills passed the House yesterday. They did not pass out the Senate bills. We're still working together on which bills overlap and how we rework them. And so I'm optimistic that we can get this done prior to our summer work district period, because it's something really important we need to do. The federal penalties are so small. We really need to demand more to make sure we end this practice in Michigan.
And that was the reason that you wanted to make it a state crime, is because the federal penalties, in your view, don't meet what they should.
The federal penalties are only up to 5 years. And what you have is some states have laws on the book to ban this that have a higher penalty. So in the bills that we proposed and have passed the Senate and the House committee, we would make it a 15-year felony. And we think it's similar to second-degree criminal sexual conduct, so it's the same sentence. We think 5 years is way too small and way too light. And it's important to note that this practice is really a cultural practice, not a religious practice. So this happens in the Muslim faith, the Christian faith, the Jewish faith, and we tend to find its roots in third world countries. And so we really need to root out, it's not a religious-based practice. We need to really root it out, and it's very small groups in which this happens. It is actually horrific. It's really about controlling women, both psychologically and physically, and we need to make sure we stand up for the girls and the women and say no more, and definitely not in Michigan.
Now, you said you started looking into this by hearing about some national figures. During the whole process of putting bills together, have you been able to get a ballpark on how often it is happening in Michigan?
State by state, it's very hard. They estimate it can happen to up to 2 million girls our country worldwide every year. And it's important to note that they tend to do this on girls. Now, it's most common when they're pre-adolescent, so 7 to 9, but it has been done on infant girls. And so there are no great numbers because they are hidden in the shadows. And like I said, it's not a religious-based practice. No faith endorses this. But when it does happen, it increases the risk of death to a girl who undergoes this procedure. When she has children, it increases her chance of death, and it definitely causes lifelong health issues for those girls who then become women. And often the women don't realize what has been done to them, as far as that it being wrong, it shouldn't have been done, until they become women and they interface with the healthcare community. Because typically these procedures are not done using physicians or a medical practice, which is what made Livonia unusual. It was a woman physician using another doctor's medical facility. That's highly unusual. It's usually done someone's home with somebody who is using broken glass, a kitchen knife, no anesthesia. So it's very odd that this happened in a medical facility, which increases chances of getting caught.
The bills that passed the House, there were just a couple of people who voted no. One of them was a Republican, Martin Hollerak, who raised concerns about the broad definition would cover some procedures legally done by plastic surgeons for those who are intersex or receiving gender reassignment surgery. Is there a legitimate concern about that?
You know, I talked to the representative, and I do not believe there is. We talked to reconstructive surgeons who have worked on this particular issue, and we have had no physician come to us and say that our language is wrong. And actually, in the Senate, we went through three different versions. We had the introduced version, and then we had three more versions because we were working with the medical community so that the language could be correct. So I believe anybody who's getting gender reassignment surgery, this does not stop it. If one really understands what female genital mutilation is, it's pretty horrendous. There is never a medical reason to do it, ever. And you know, probably in its tamest form, which is still horrifying to you and I, it's really about sewing the female vagina shut. And it's not like it's just a loose stitch that's on the outside. They go in a half inch in, and sew it shut. And on the wedding night, the husband gets to cut the wife open. That is at its tamest that I can describe it. So I do not see where the representative, where his concerns really were going to interface with that issue.
Let me ask you about the bills concerning prescription of opiates. There are people, of course, who have legitimate pain needs, but there's also a great concern about addiction. How do you balance those two things?
That is a great question. And I think that's why you see there's about 20 bills that have been introduced, and not all of them will pass. You know, I introduced three bills, not with the expectation that they pass, but with the expectation we're going to finally talk about things we haven't talked about. Two of the bills I partnered with Minority Leader Jim Ananick, Senator out of Flint, on. And those bills specifically target doctors who intentionally are writing prescriptions for addicts. And they're not for medical necessity, but rather they're fraudulent prescriptions. And we want to go after, make it a felony, strip the license from that physician. Now, are we saying this bill has to pass? No, but we do want to talk about, we know in Michigan, there are a handful of physicians who are writing the largest number of prescriptions for opioids. And it's not in relation to diagnoses in their area. And we think that we need to do a better job of enforcement. And if the state licensing board is not going to go after them, or their associations of which they're a member of are not going to go after them, then the state is going to put in our own law. So we just want to have the discussion. And we've had some wonderful discussions with physicians who also want it to stop. You know, another bill that I had introduced was there is a opioid that has a deterrent in it, a prescription, so that you don't become addicted. It is more expensive. And the bill says the copays are going to be the same. Now, does it have to pass? No, but we want to force everyone to the table, the physician, the health insurance companies, the patients, about what is right for this person. If they have been an addict, why would we write them a prescription to something that's highly addictive when there is another drug out there that is not addictive that can take care of their pain? Wouldn't that save some treatment costs? So we want to start the conversations. Not all the bills will pass, but I'll tell you, we're having conversations we never had before.
I'm trying to wrap my mind around the idea of the doctor you mentioned, you know, a select number of doctors who are prescribing these to people who are already addicted. Is there a profit motive in there? Is there something, are they just lax? Are they, I mean, what is the problem that these few doctors are trying to get? I mean, what, I guess I'm trying to see the motivation there. And I'm trying to, as someone who's not in the medical community, trying to understand it. I mean, have you gotten at it?
That's what we're now starting to have conversations about. And in fact, the licensing board is starting to look into, because there is no rhyme or reason why these particular physicians are writing so many prescriptions. And it's important for people to know that if you have an opioid product, you have an addictive drug, Vicodin, Percocet, OxyContin in your home, there are people who, if they know you have it, they're interested in robbing your home to get that drug. Sometimes it's to feed their own addiction. Often it's to sell it on the street. So are the doctors writing these prescriptions to people who are, they're addicted and they're taking on their own and they just need a higher dosage? Or are they writing prescriptions to people who are selling it on the street? Is it a very profitable drug? And for those who need this drug to survive day to day, if your prescription is stolen, you don't get a refill. I had a friend who had a family member that stole their Vicodin from their house, and they had a legitimate pain issue. When they went to the doctor, they said, sorry, we have to wait till your next refill before you can get it. So it really hurts the people who are truly in pain if we have people who are selling it on the street.
You mentioned that this is kind of bringing people to the table, and maybe some of this legislation is not going to pass or get signed into law. But I guess I'm wondering, based on, you know, everything you've heard now, how big a problem do we have? And, you know, what are we talking about in terms of how big a solution we need?
That is probably the magic question. How big is the problem and what is the solution? The problem's pretty big. Michigan has led the nation in opioid deaths per capita. It is a severe problem, and it doesn't just impact one particular group. It's very widespread. What I appreciate with the physicians doing is they've really talked about how, you know, when we were talking about assisted suicide back when Jack Kevorkian was assisting people in that, the conversation became, a patient should never suffer. They should never have pain. And so pain became the quality measure of health care. Well, now pain is still the quality measure of health care. If your patient is in pain, it's deemed that there is a problem. We all know pain's a part of our life. Now, how do we manage pain, treat pain? But is it reasonable to expect that people will never be in pain? When I had foot surgery, I only wanted the pain meds that made my life manageable until I recovered from it. I never had the expectation I would be in no pain. And I can only imagine what I would have been on if my expectation had been, while recovering, I was in no pain. Because I was on a pretty high dose of Percocet. But I only wanted it so I could manage to get through every day and sleep a little bit at night. So I think we all have to readjust our thinking, and the physicians are really leading that conversation. And I appreciate what they're bringing to the table, because they're bringing to us, did you know that we are rated by the healthcare companies on if our people are in pain? If our people are in pain, it's considered bad.
And patient satisfaction surveys often include how much pain were you in, et cetera, those sort of things.
And it's heavily weighted towards pain. So if you would have surveyed me, yes, I was in pain, but I was managing my own pain. I never had the expectation of no pain. But if I would have gotten one of those surveys and answered, yes, I'm still in pain, my doctor could have gotten an unfavorable rating by the health insurance company.
And in theory, the next time they had a patient who had had foot surgery, they might be upping the doses in order to make sure that they don't get another quote-unquote unfavorable review.
Exactly. And that's where the push was. And the origins of that push were good. We did not want people who are terminally ill to be in pain. And it creeped into, we don't want anyone in everyday medicine being in pain. So I think we need to talk more. And my pain was very manageable because I knew going into my surgery what my expectations were, what the recovery would be like. So I wasn't surprised with the pain. I knew I'd had a great conversation with my physician. So I felt that my pain was very manageable. And, you know, hopefully this will open up the door for more conversations with our physicians. And it also will maybe bring more risk analysis. If they're going to give a prescription to somebody, have they been addicted to other things in the past? Are they at risk for becoming addictive to a heavy narcotic?
You've also introduced some bills related to animal fighting and cruelty, in part because there were some people in the Kalamazoo area who you said had been convicted and they did not get any jail time, right?
Yeah, there were three high-profile cases in Kalamazoo County. Two of them, it was their second conviction of dog fighting. The other person, it was their third conviction of dog fighting. And the most any of them got was a few days in the county jail, even though the current law says a judge can sentence them 0 to 4 years of jail time or prison time. They really walked away with a slap on their wrist. And I have to tell you, when you look at dog fighting and you look at what accompanies it, typically there's drugs involved, often abuse of children. There's a lot of violence. There can be robbery. Dog fighting in and of itself is not the only crime. There tends to be a lot of other crimes that are involved with it. And so we need to be able to say enough is enough. You know, these dogs, they are being forced to fight. If they do not fight, they are either tortured, or if the torture doesn't work to make them fight, then they are killed. That's just something none of us can stand for. And it's absolutely horrific. I have two dogs of my own, and these dogs are specifically trained to be this way. And it's very sad, but it's also sad when you see all the drugs that are in it. And if any of the people involved have kids, their kids are typically have been abused pretty severely who are involved. So this is not just about dog fighting. It's about the greater influence and the ill that surrounds it. And we really have to stop it. So these bills would say a second time conviction is a minimum 18 months in prison, no longer discretion. We have to make this serious.
All right. Let me shift here to a slightly lighter topic, but also involving dogs. You sponsored the legislation which would say that someone can have their dog with them on an outdoor patio if they're at a restaurant. Why do you think that this was something, and I think you've proposed it actually before in the last session, if I remember right. Why did you think that this was something that Michigan restaurants and maybe tourist destinations needed?
Well, I was approached by two different types of people. One were restaurant owners who said, my niche market is people who spend 2, 3, 4 hours here. If you think of some of our breweries where people go and literally will spend 2 or 3 hours, it's not a 45-minute turnaround dinner time. They said, we want our clientele to be able to bring their dogs because they work all day. They want to come here. We've got games they can play outdoors. But they say, I don't want to leave my dog at home. They've been gone. They've been at home all day without me. And then there were tourists, people in Michigan who go to Arizona, to Florida. And there are restaurants that allow dogs in outdoor patios. But when they travel Michigan, they have dog-friendly hotels. They have dog parks, even dog drinking fountains. But they cannot have fine dining. And one such person even told me the other day, they said, Margaret, you know, so we decide, well, we'll leave our dog in the car, run in, get maybe some takeout, and then so we can get some fine dining and come back. And you should see the people yelling at us for leave our dog in the car. What do? We can't leave him at the hotel. We can't leave him at the campground. So basically, we're stuck going to McDonald's. We can't enjoy the fine dining. And if you want beer, well, you can't drink beer in your car. So they feel very stuck. And this legislation is purely opt-in. Most restaurants won't do it. First, it says any restaurant that wishes to do this, here are the minimum health and safety standards so we can protect the patrons and the pets. Second, any community can ban this or put more rules on it if they wish. And then third, every restaurant gets to decide if they want to do it. And if they want to do it, they can put further rules on it. I estimate 95% of your restaurants will not do this at all. You might have 5%, and those are going to be those niche places where the dining is not about just coming and eating the food and leaving. It's really about staying for 2 to 3 hours. And so most people are very fearful. They do not want dogs there. Trust me, most places you go, the dogs will still not be there. This is really for those niche places.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. We are speaking with State Senator Margaret O'Brien. She represents Kalamazoo County in the State Senate. Let me ask you about the state budget. Apparently, there is a framework of an agreement around the teacher retirement system. And let me back up here and ask you about this, because I had a conversation with a couple of people who cover the Capitol intently. They're there all the time, and they were a little surprised, I guess, that the teacher retirement system, MIPSERS as it's known, has become such an important part of this. You know, the Senate majority leader said that if there was not reform to the system, he wasn't sure when a state budget was going to get passed. Do you see reform of MIPSERS as a top priority?
I wish this were a simple answer. I do not see where anything needs to change to the teacher retirement fund that would hold up the budget. I understand the Senate Majority Leader's concerns that he wants to accommodate it in the budget, but I think it's a broader policy question. You know, when I got elected in 2011 to the State House, I was part of a group of freshmen who held up the budget in 2011 and said, we believe something has to be done to the teacher retirement system, MEPSERS. We knew there was a problem. We knew it was underfunded and schools were paying too much to put into the system. And so I've been part of that conversation since I first started in 2011. It wasn't until November or December of last year that people said there's a problem with the hybrid system. So let's just because most people don't know this, including some of the people in our education system. Under Governor Granholm, the old 100% pension system ended, and a hybrid system was created. So teachers could choose, do you want a part pension, part defined contribution plan, or do you want a total defined contribution plan? And so this hybrid retirement system came about. And most of the teachers picked the hybrid because, frankly, The 401k that's offered to them is horrible. It does not even equal what state employees are being given for their 401k. So they were essentially forced into the hybrid plan because it's simply better than the 401k. So it wasn't until November or December last year that anybody said, hey, the hybrid has a problem. I can't tell you if the hybrid has a problem yet or not. It was created in 2010. It was not even funded into the 2011-2012 budget because that's when it took effect. Not a single person is drawing retirement on it because it was only new enrollees that went in. So when we say there's a problem, we're projecting there may be a problem. I'm happy to go through that exercise. But more importantly, if we just simply offered a better 401k match like state employees get, let the teachers choose where they want to go. I believe most of them will choose the 401k system. Now, if we don't close out the hybrid and we just increase the 401k match and let teachers choose, I think the problem will take care of itself. I do think defined contribution in today's day and age allows people to be more mobile and not lose their retirement if they decide to change jobs. But I question the process and how we've gone about it and how it has to be directly linked to the budget. That's where I've probably had some disagreements with it. I'm always happy to discuss how we ensure that the promises made to the teachers are kept, but I don't want them to be political footballs.
One of the things that makes this somewhat timely is that we're at about the time of the year where the state budget has been completed now since Governor Snyder was sworn in. And the date that the state budget actually has to be completed is not until October 1st, but it is seen as better for local governments and state universities and community colleges that generally have a fiscal year starting July 1st that the state budget gets done early. So is that part of the concern that you're raising there is that you're putting that deadline, a little closer to July 1st and maybe even putting it in jeopardy of getting completed by then if you're going to have a long debate on the retirement system?
Exactly. You know, the budget, both the House and the Senate had left unallocated funds, depending on the budget, between $400 to $600 million was left unallocated for this particular conversation about the teacher retirement system. We did not have to link it to the budget. I understand there are some who feel they needed to link it to the budget in order to maybe get the governor to consider another point of view, but I think the governor would have been happy to consider another point of view no matter what. And so where I have a little bit of discomfort in is linking two issues that I think really are separate. Yes, if we change to a solely defined contribution system, we have to have the money. We set aside the money. We had left unallocated money. And I do worry about about people who are starting their budgets on July 1st. We want to make sure we give some certainty. And so I do believe we're going to be done before July 1st, but I think there was some extra weeks thrown in that postponed it that didn't need to be done. I have faith in the Senate Majority Leader to push good public policy. I just disagreed probably with how the process on this went forward. I would have preferred a different process, and I would have preferred a much different tone to the conversation.
Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly has proposed a ballot proposal, would amend the state constitution and make the legislature part-time. As someone who has now been there since 2011, has seen how it works in both the state House and the state Senate, do you think that the legislature can get its work done in a 90-day window, which is what his proposal includes?
You know, I've always favored a part-time legislature, but the proposal that I had backed in the past was one that capped the number of days and also had capped the salary, but it wasn't so prescriptive in the 90 days. So I have not seen his proposal in writing because he's withdrawn it a couple times. But from what he has said, it's 90 consecutive days. Well, per the dictionary, consecutive means one after another. So are we going to expect our legislature, Sunday through Saturday, for 90 days to be in session? The lieutenant governor said it could be any 90 days. Well, the Constitution already prescribes which Wednesday in January both the House and the Senate must come to order. And according to his presentation of his proposal, that once we start session, we only have 90 days. So if we have to start on a particular Wednesday in January, then that means we will be done prior to April. So the expectation is we're going to do a budget. He has said that under his proposal, he wants a two-year budget. So we're going to have a shorter time period. We got to get 2 years of work done. Now, I'm going to tell you that we've had some particular challenges in the legislature. We've had the unemployment agency issue. We've had the Grand Rapids Veterans Home issue, and we've had the Flint water issue. Those did not rear their head in the first 90 days of the calendar year. So I am concerned about when the legislature is called upon to fix a crisis, which we have been called upon every time to fix it. We're the only ones that can decide to fund. The governor gets to propose. We get to dispose. We get to say yes or no or come up with our own solution. And so I'm concerned about what about emergencies? And does that put the executive in too much power the way this is written so that they could maybe hide an emergency and we would be powerless? So what's that going to mean? But then second, we need to have an honest conversation. I don't like it when I'm told I only work 90 days a year. We might only have between 90 to 110 session days a year. Today is not a session day. I started my first appointment at 9 a.m. I will have met nonstop without a single bathroom break until 4 o'clock today. And this is an early day. Most days, I start very early. I'm usually up at 5 a.m. on the road prior to 6, not at home till 9 or 10 at night. So I don't think it's fair
even,
to
even
say—
Even when you're not in session.
Even when I'm not in session. Look at all the community events we are blessed to have. People want us there. If I'm only going to get paid for working 90 days, so are you, you're saying you expect me to have another job to support my family. Are you then still expecting me to work 7 days a week? Because there are events going on in our community 7 days a week that I go to. Are you expecting me to work 7 days a week and somehow fitting that in with another job? I mean, I don't think we're having a transparent conversation with the voters. A part-time legislature means we're not working 7 days a week anymore. We're not working around the clock anymore. And I'm okay with that. But when you try to say I'm only going to work 90 days and we're going to do it here, I have talked about so many diverse issues this morning that I don't know when those people would get to see me if I only work 90 days. Because I'm going to be, it's Friday. It's a work day. And then what employer is going to give me 90 consecutive days off? Teachers will not be allowed to run for legislature. They're going to miss 90 of their 180 days of instruction. So are we going to be shutting it out? I back a part-time legislature. I think it needs to be more thoughtful and more inclusive so more people can run, but you're also not just blanketing out, you're shutting out the community entirely from their elected body.
Do you think that if there is a move to a part-time legislature, that that should be coupled with some sort of lengthening of term limits? That's a concern that some lawmakers have raised, that already we have only a really few people up there right now who have been in the legislature for any length of time to develop some expertise. A lot of lawmakers say they rely heavily on, say, the House and Senate fiscal agencies. So, I mean, if there's going to be a move to a part-time legislature, should lawmakers be given some more time to serve in the state House and Senate?
I think that is something we should look at. I'm going to give you an example of my first year. So in my first year, I was right in saying we had to address the unfunded liabilities in the teacher pension system. I was absolutely right on the issue. And in fact, it was a group of freshmen who hijacked our budget and demanded action. We were right. Where we were wrong was the solution that year. We thought we knew what we were talking about because we had researched it. We had investigated it. And our proposal was, let's give the schools an extra per pupil allotment of money to buy down what they were having to put in. So that's how we chose to fund the system. After that got passed and signed by the governor, we learned to our horror that we had not funded any of the liabilities of any of the educators at our ISDs, our intermediate school districts. They're not funded on a per pupil basis. So this happened in June. So I had 6 months to identify my issue, research the issue, and come up with a solution to solve this problem. And yet in 6 months, I found the wrong solution.
You still needed to fix it again.
I had to fix it again. And that came at my local superintendent at the time, Ron Fuller, was head of KRESA. And he was like, Margaret, I love what you were doing, which was tackling this problem. Did you just realize we still had all that liability? You did nothing to help us. And so then by the next year, I was prepared for a better solution. Within 3 months, would I have identified the problem and the solution? I don't know. I can guarantee I wouldn't have found the right solution because I didn't find it in 6 months. And with a 2-year budget, it would have been 2 years of creating this disparity amongst educators, depending how they were funded. And so I've learned a lot, and in the Senate, people tend to vote their representatives into the Senate. So the Senate tends to have experience. Whoever the governor is hires experience. They hire former legislators, former department directors. The house is the one with constant turnover. And I can tell you from being someone in the house who had identified the right problem and came up with the wrong solution, we need to do more to have an equal playing field with the house so that they're not always left with a little bit less expertise. So I do worry about over-reliance on staff and on lobbyists, neither of which are elected.
Margaret O'Brien, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
State Senator Margaret O'Brien is a Republican. She represents Kalamazoo County in the Michigan Senate. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.